Hi, my name is Allison Mead, and welcome to LAFPI's podcast series. The Los Angeles Female Playwrights Initiative is dedicated to encouraging and promoting the work of female playwrights, and today I'm going to be speaking with Jill Charlotte Thomas, who's California Dreamin', is currently playing at the Met Theater in Hollywood. Charlotte has had three plays previously produced at the Met, including David, Autobiography, and Audition, and she served as casting director for the Met's production of Window of Opportunity. She's a published poet and is currently at work on a musical, which we'll find out more about in a moment. So welcome, Charlotte.
Hi, thank you.
Well, California Dreamin' is a fascinating play that takes a very different look at the Tate-LaBianca murders of 1969. So I wondered if you could start out by telling me what originally attracted you to this material and kind of how you went about researching events around this time period.
Okay, so what happened was I actually the plays that I did, they were short plays at the theater, at the Met Theater, and I was living in Los Feliz, and I was over at the theater one day, and I had an idea about this. It was sort of like the initial kernel, and then the little green there. And so I was over there. I talked to somebody, and he said, let me take you over to this house next door to the LaBianca's. It's only a couple miles away from the theater. And he said, I want to show you this place because his family's Catholic and his mother used to give cocktail parties there in the 70s. And in 1969, it was a private residence. And so we went there. This is a 15-acre estate, two swimming pools, a vineyard, and it's next door to the LaBianca's, okay? Mm-hmm. And 1969 is a private residence owned by Bernadine and Daniel Donahue. And then in 1971, Bernadine Donahue died in 68. So in 1971, Daniel Donahue donated it to the Catholic Church. And I kind of lost my train of thought here. I'm getting off on a tangent.
Okay, as you're thinking about that, I'm just going to remind people that the Tate-LaBianca murders are associated with Charles Manson. I should have probably mentioned that up front.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, so it turned out that these people also donated. It was either the science building or the library at a private Catholic girls' school where Abigail Folger attended, and the Folger family donated whichever one that they didn't. It was the library or the science department, and they're both Catholics. And there were a couple of, you know, interesting things that I kept finding out that just led me to writing this play. And also one thing, I'd mentioned to my mom that if I were Mrs. Folger, I would be really annoyed. I'd be thinking, how come nobody remembers my daughter's name? I mean, it was heinous what happened to everyone, especially Sharon Tate. She was pregnant, but at the same time, Abigail Folger was stabbed 21 times. So nobody remembers her name. And my mom had said, you know, if that had happened to you, your father and I would have done the same thing. And I kept thinking, you know, I said, what do you mean? Like, what did they do? And just that idea of, what are you saying, but they would have done the same thing. And then I went and began the play on that note.
The story centers around Abigail Folger, who was, just to remind everyone who might be listening, was a coffee heiress and a victim of the murders in Sharon Tate's home on August 8th. And it also centers around this relationship with Charles Manson that I'm guessing she may or may not have had. Is there a kind of apocryphal evidence of that?
You know, I would just say, I don't want to answer that. I would say I don't know. I wasn't there. There are some things. There's this. Okay, Abigail Folger went to the Esalen Institute, okay? And I think, and then there was a noted, there was the telephone call that was made, or I think it was received at this Yellow Drive, which is where the Tate murders happened.
Okay.
It was there from the Esalen Institute, and I think that was maybe the 2nd of August. The murders happened on the early morning of the 9th, and Charles Manson was at the Esalen Institute maybe on a the Tuesday before the Friday, which was when the murders happened. So just a few interesting things.
So there was enough there to interest you, to kind of get you interested as a playwright in the story and then maybe to connect the dots in a way that maybe is fictional, but
it's completely fictional. I just connected some fun dots in Ed Sanders' book, The Family.
Okay.
He said that this is just Ed Sanders' book, and I don't know. I didn't do any research other than I looked at this, you know, I read this book. I took a bunch of notes from Helter Skelter Ed Sanders, The Family. I read Charles Manson's book and Tex Watson's book. And then I just wrote a fictional play. But there was one instance where it said in Ed Sanders' book that Charles Manson was seen driving a red Ferrari in the month of July, and sitting next to him was a girl with a scarf on her head, you know, I think wearing sunglasses or something, at least a scarf on her head. Well, Sharon Tate owned a red Ferrari, and Sharon Tate was in Europe. And in the 60s, a red Ferrari was not as common as it would be now. It's not maybe that common now, but it was not common then.
Right.
You know, so if you saw Charles Manson driving a red Ferrari, you might remember that.
Right. Yeah, he seems to have cut quite a figure through Los Angeles around that time. How did you find out originally about the relationship, or did it kind of just emerge from the other work you were just saying you did?
Well, no, I'm just guessing that there was a relationship.
Okay, so you're intuiting a relationship based on information, and then how did that process, that spark, start to develop into a play for you?
I don't know. You know, sometimes when I write something, it just seems to make an impression as far as this is going to be a book or this is going to be a play. This one just seemed like I could see it visually, and I wanted to be there with them sort of happening, and it just seemed like theater was the best venue for this. Is that answering your question?
Yeah, absolutely. No? Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I'm just so curious because it's such a fascinating story that really goes against sort of the common, quote-unquote, wisdom of what happened and why this happened. But it's just, I imagine it's pretty controversial, and you probably heard some yays or nays or whatever because it's such a hotly debated thing.
Okay, here's a couple of things. I thought this was interesting. I mean, some people have critiqued the play and said, have really liked it, and that's always great, but it's so crazy to read those criticisms because you can lose your head in them. I mean, some people are really mean about their dislike of it, or they're thinking that there's no way a man like Charles Manson is going to meet a girl like Abigail Folger. And I think, you know what, you are completely right. I mean, look at Patty Hearst. I mean, who would think that a Hearst, you know, girl is going to get involved with a Symbionese Liberation Army?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, these things are so left field, it's completely impossible. So on that note, I thought sometimes the pendulum does swing both ways. You know what I mean? And if you're involved in drugs, which if in Helter Skelter, so I'm not, I just don't want to get in trouble by anybody. But in Helter Skelter, let's see, Vincent Bugliosi does say that Abigail's drug had a drug problem, and that her problem was now becoming more than just a casual dabbling. It was, you know, it was definitely, they'd gone beyond the point of experimentation, and that her mother, Mrs. Folger, did volunteer work at the Haight-Ashbury Drug Clinic, and she also gave cocktail parties for the drug clinic recipients. So all these things that seem so far-fetched, like, are you kidding? These things I found on the Internet, but basically in Helter Skelter and Ed Sanders' book, The Family.
That's really fascinating. And then Abigail herself is kind of presented as a very interesting character of many sides. It seems like, did she also do some sort of charitable work? It seemed like on one hand she was pretty self-involved and obviously had been born into wealth and privilege, but on another hand seemed very interested in social ideas.
I think she worked on Bobby Kennedy's campaign, and she was working at, in Watts. So for certain things there. And I think she was, you know, a girl who was really trying to figure out what she wanted to do in life. I mean, she went to Radcliffe. She graduated from there with honors. And that would have been in the early 60s. And she was an accomplished equestrian. She spoke fluent French. She played classical, you know, or piano, you know, classical piano, whatever, classical music. And she seemed like a very interesting girl who did have a lot, everything given to her. But by the same token, you know, this is a girl who went to Radcliffe and graduated with honor, so she wasn't exactly just painting her toenails.
Right. It seems like there's that inner conflict within her character, it helps with the play. And I wondered how that inner conflict helped you flesh her out on the page.
Well, yeah, okay, honestly, I really liked her working on this play a lot. I mean, I really wanted to be true to her. I mean, I don't know this woman, obviously, and et cetera, but I didn't want to write anything with, I wanted to write with integrity, that I did base her parents on my parents, because just some of the comments that Mr. Folger said, I said them that way. And also I felt like, you know, they had Mr. Folger is buried up north in Colma, and it's in, I think they call it Millionaire's there's like a cemetery up there, a Catholic cemetery, but in the one area where he's at, it's very exclusive. And his daughter's in the crypt, and her mother's next to her. And I thought, you know, if something had happened to me like that, my dad would have done the same thing. He'd be thinking he doesn't want some, you know, whatever, to dig me up, et cetera. And so he would put me in the wall. You know what I mean?
I see. So it sounds like you share a socioeconomic background with Abigail Folger, and maybe that's one point of connection with the two of you.
That would probably be it, but not quite on her level.
Okay.
But I would say, yeah, there was probably that. Everybody's sort of always looking at Sharon Tate, and she definitely would take the headlines. I mean, she was beautiful, 8 months pregnant, married to Roman Polanski, and she's an actress herself, young, wealthy. I mean, no matter where you turn, you're going to look at her. And I think that it was easy for the family to kind of have people look at her and not their daughter.
Mm.
Because I think the father was trying to protect his daughter as any parent would. I mean, you know, you're going to love your child. You don't want to have them messed up in that and have their name be slandered. They've already been through a heinous crime. Who wants that? And people, you know, I mean, when you read about how many people were supposed to have been at the Tate house the night of the murder, so they'd been invited up there for dinner, it would have ended up being like 20 people or something.
I guess at the end, I understand now why a little bit more why the possible relationship and the possible motive for the murders was kept out of the press. But I wondered what you wanted people to take away from the play.
Let's see. That's a really good question. Let me try to think of that one. I think I'm older now than I was, hopefully somewhat wiser, and I think that people make a lot of bad choices when they're high, whatever drug you're going to talk about, whether it's acid or methamphetamine or whatever. And I think it's just something that connects to these days, like with the drug situation, and also economically or politically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, remember with Manson sort of ranting and stuff? I don't think things have changed that much. I mean, they have. You know, the names and faces have changed, but we have so many similar things going on right now.
No, I think I understand what you're saying. There does seem to be similar consequences. As you read the play, and probably as you see it, I haven't seen it staged yet, but as you read it's very contemporary.
Allison, you haven't seen it yet?
No, I just read it.
Oh, are you going to go to see it?
I do want to see it, yeah. Because it does feel very contemporary. The events talked about and a lot of the things that Charlie is having problems with do feel very of the news today.
You know, that was another thing, too. I mean, okay, this is a man who's very magnetic. He's got some of these women. I mean, obviously, okay, they're runaways. They've got problems, this and that. And they get into drugs, and they meet up with this guy, and they're going to get on his bus, and they're going to go traveling around and then live in the desert. But at the same point, he's not, I don't think, he wasn't initially at knife point picking up all these people. They seem to go from, you know, on their own, by their own free will. So he had to have some kind of magnetism. And if you read his book, he's now at Dennis Wilson's house at some point. He's meeting these people. You know, Terry Melcher wisely decided not to sign him, but at the same time, there was a point where he even met him or connected with him. And so to make him out to be this comic book crazy villain, you know, who's sort of like Snidely Whiplash or the Boogeyman, you know, personified, like, oh, my God. I thought that was a bit ridiculous, and I wanted to bring them down to a point where you could understand and where you, the audience, felt like, wow, you know, now I can see how this could have happened, instead of looking at it from a distance and being able to judge and go, oh, my God, can you imagine people doing that? I would never do that. And I wanted to put people in a situation where they actually thought, oh, God, I can see how this is something bad. Like, maybe this was, like, the original stalker or something like that. You know what I'm saying? Where I wanted you to feel eerie. Like, all of a sudden, something's turning, and you have no control of it, and you can see how a bad situation or a situation that somebody's walking into, it's almost like, no, don't go in that room, and then too late. So that's sort of what I wanted to do, too. I wanted to make him not such a scary guy. I mean, I think the guy is horrible, but at the same time, you know, if you make him so ridiculous, it's easy for people to point their fingers and not have any connection. You have to, maybe things like that, remember that these things can repeat themselves if people don't, you know, take heed. Yeah, but I'll tell you something. I probably shouldn't tell you this, but I know I really shouldn't, but I'm going to. It was really fun. Okay, so really quick, I was with my mom. We were in San Francisco. My dad had recently died. I had his death certificate. I compared it to Abigail Folger's because when you print it out, it has these smudges. That I couldn't tell what they were. But anyway, one was, okay, where you died, and the next one was where you were living, right? Now, her address where she was living was not the same as Laurel Canyon. It was a place in San Francisco. So I really wanted to see what this place was about, if this was her mother's place or was it her own apartment, even though she's supposed to be living in Laurel Canyon with her boyfriend. So my mom and I, we were up there, and I talked to the concierge of this hotel because we were actually going to my dad's gravesite. And so we were talking to the concierge, and he ended up saying, oh, yeah. So I just made up some story that my mom was interested in buying an apartment up there or something, and could they get us a realtor? So we ended up in the apartment building. And oddly enough, the broker said to us when he first greeted us, well, I'm going to show you a unit now. I hope you guys like it. It was actually Mrs. Folger's. And then he stopped himself, and I was like, what? And so he said, I know, I shouldn't have told you that. I'm like, why did you say that? You know, some people wouldn't want to live there. And he said, I don't know, I felt I should. So the entire process of doing research from this was as if everything, we got to go to the Esalen Institute for 2 hours. You really can't go there unless you're going to go there for the weekend or for the week. I mean, so many things like that kept happening. It was unbelievable. So it was it just wrote itself. It was a really crazy place.
Interesting. Well, that is really fascinating. I do want to ask you, though, about your musical. You're working on a musical now.
Oh, okay. So the musical is called Summer Holiday, and I don't know how much I'm supposed to tell. We're working on this. Hopefully the Met's going to do it. I'm not sure. And the songs, the lyrics are done, and the characters, I'm just having a little bit of a glitch with my storyline, which I want to fix. I don't really want to give it away because it's obviously not a summer holiday, and the summer holiday, well, it's not obvious, but it isn't a summer holiday. Summer holiday is the lead character's name. And it's about a girl who goes into a meth house, and there she befriends a schizophrenic, a manic depressive, a multiple personality, and an anorexic model, and it's her journey out.
So you're attracting very light, happy topics in general.
I know. I know, you think. I had such a nice childhood. Oh, boy. Maybe it dropped me on my head. I don't know.
Well, it sounds really interesting, and we will look forward to hearing that from you. So thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today.
Oh, you're so well. Thank you very much.
And for more information about tickets, visit www.brownpapertickets.com/event/221462 or call 800-838-3006. For more information about LAFPI's resources, activities, and opportunities, please visit lafpi.com.